Okay, so the recorder is on. While I'm adjusting levels, the first thing I'm going to say is today's date, so that we know that. Today is August 11th, 2017. My name is Liz Strong. I'm here conducting an interview with Robert Thompson about the Paddle Weeksville and the Hunter Fly Roadhouses. This is for the New York Preservation and Archive Project's Oral History Project, Saving Preservation Stories. Okay, so that's all the information we need on the tape. So you were just telling me where you and your family are from and what your history is in Brooklyn.
Okay. Well, I guess our history in Brooklyn started with my grandparents who moved here from a little town in North Carolina called New Britain, North Carolina, in the 20s. My mother was born in 1929, and she's still alive. And she moved, it's really interesting because almost all of us moved back down south. Most of my family that moved here in, like I said, in the 20s, almost all of them are now back in the south in some way, which is quite an interesting migration story. Well, the story of African Americans in America is about immigration, about being moved from one place to another. And so that's a history. I mean, like I said, my family, I can document my family back to about the 1850s. There was a person in our family named Diane Dale who wrote a history of our family, at least from my mother, on my mother's side. And in the history, it's called The Village That Made Us. She wrote a book, actually. It's called The Village That Made Us, and it's about she and that part of the family is reside mostly in Washington, D.C., in Anacostia. And we started a museum there, too, the Anacostia Museum, which is part of the Smithsonian. My great uncle was one of the founding board members. His name was Elmo Dale.
And you can see him writing all this down because I'm going to look it up later.
Okay. So that's kind of, I mean, we, I don't know, for some reason our family wound up in the museum business. I don't think it was planned or organized. It just sort of happens that way.
Did it start with your mother, or was it something that just...
Yeah, I think for me it started with my mother. My grandparents weren't really all that much into history, but my mother was like a real history buff. And she was a very exceptional person. Back in those days, back in the 50s and the 60s, museums in New York were free. And being a single working mother, she didn't really have a whole lot of money for, you know, amusement parks and stuff that cost money. So we would make sandwiches, and we would go to the museums. And by the time I was 12, I probably went to every museum in the city of New York. I kid you not. I mean, the Staten Island Museum, the Brooklyn Museum, the Museum of the American Indian, the Jewish Museum. I mean, you name it. We went there because it was free. And, you know, after a while, you know, I mean, initially I would say to her, you know, we went there already, but she said, there's a new show. And so we would go. And my two favorite museums were the Museum of Natural History, because they had these big dinosaurs. I don't know if they're still there. But as a kid, you know, you're like 5 years old, and you see this Tyrannosaurus Rex. It looks like the biggest thing in the world. And the Met were my two favorite places because it was just so enormous and, like I said, it was always changing. And they had these model, in the Met, they had these model rooms, you know, with, you know, furniture, and they were decorated in the period, you know, Louis XIV or, you know, early American. And then in the Museum of Natural History, of course, they had all these stuffed animals in these sort of cycloramas, you know, try to put them in the natural settings. And, you know, again, as a kid, you know, you go into this dark room with these lit, you know, displays. It was just, you know, it was fascinating. So I sort of grew up in museums. And before we were so security conscious, there used to be these huge ocean liners, like the Queen Mary and the USA, and, you know, before airfare was common. So people, you know, wealthy people would, you know, take these cruises back and forth. So I was born in 49, so I wasn't 10, so we're talking early 50s. When the boats would dock just before they would leave, they would open the boat to the public, and anybody could go on. And Mother and I would, and my brother, she would take us onto these boats, and we would crash people's bon voyage parties. And, you know, as a kid, you never think of it. But now that I look back on it, we were the only black people there. And, you know, here's this woman with these two little black kids eating these people's hors d'oeuvres. And nobody ever said anything to us. Nobody. I think, you know, my mother was always, if you dress appropriately and you act like you belong, nobody will ever say anything to you. And particularly in those days, you know, during the civil rights, you know, people were sensitive and, you know, about, you know, offending people. But yeah, we would go, but it wasn't, everybody would do. I mean, people were going from party hopping to party hopping. So it wasn't that unusual for people to do it. But for a woman with two little black kids, I guess it was unusual. I said before, at the time, I didn't think anything of it. But now that I look back on it, I mean, that was the kind of person she was. She was very, when we go on trips, like we go to Washington, where her family, we got a lot of family there. We would go to the Smithsonian. I probably went to every Smithsonian museum that there is. Not just the Air and Space Museum, which was our favorite, but the Portrait Gallery and the Museum of America. And every museum, the Post Office Museum, you know. So we were kind of, by the time I was in my 20s, I was pretty much indoctrinated into this whole thing. And so that's, I was a filmmaker back then, and I was working at Pratt Institute. I was the director of media services there back in, I guess, so this is 70, 70, 70s? Jeez, early 70s, wow. When did I start at Pratt? No, well, before Pratt, I worked at City University, Bronx Community College. That's where I first started, in 71, yeah. And I was back then they called you an audiovisual tech. So you were the guy that went to the classroom and showed the films. But back then, they were just beginning to develop industrial television. So colleges were able to buy, you know, cameras and develop. So we were one of the first schools in the city system to actually develop an in-house TV studio. It was all black and white back then. It was tape. It wasn't digital. I mean, you physically had to cut the tape to edit it. You put these little things on it. But anyway, Mother... So this is before she left for Europe. But anyway, she remarried a serviceman. And I graduated from high school in 1967, and I went away to college for my first year. And her husband was stationed overseas. So as something for her to do, she started taking this, she took this course at, I want to say Pratt, on... ethnic contributions to New York. And so, of course, being black, they wanted to, you know, find out what were the African-American contributions to New York. And they had a real difficult time back in those days because there wasn't a whole lot there. So they started to do their own research. My mother's a very avid researcher. And in the process of, you know, looking for information about black people in New York, they stumbled across Weeksville. And I think it was on a map. They saw it on a map first. And then they did more research and they found out this was, you know, a black community, and that it started by this guy, James Weeks, and that it really grew after the draft riots when a lot of blacks were driven out of Manhattan and came for refuge in Brooklyn. And then they just started this. So she became really like fascinated with it. And I remember I really, so I guess this is 67, so I was like 17, 18 years old. I remember seeing an article in the New York Times about what she was doing. And it just sort of kind of dawned on me that maybe this is really important. You know, the New York Times thinks it's worthwhile doing a story. So that's sort of how I became involved in it through my mother. She was one of the founders of the Weeksville Society and the first secretary. And so she still has notes that she took from back then. She's also a pack rat. She likes to collect stuff. So she has her notes from the first Weeksville meeting. So I was in school, and I came back to New York in 70. Yeah, I guess it was either, because, you know, 67, 68, 69. Yeah, around 70, 69, 70, I came back to New York, and I transferred to school back here. And my mother, by that time, had gone overseas to live with her husband. They were living in England. And so I would, you know, I would spend the school year here in the States and the summers in England with them. Because they lived in this. My mother was always a very adventurous person. She refused to live on the base. And she says, you know, I didn't come 3,000 miles to sit on a piece of America in another country, you know, because American bases overseas, you know, you just like take a piece of Kansas, cut it up. They had their own schools, everything. And there were people on the base that never left the base. They spend the whole 4 year tour of duty on the base and never leave. So my mother refused that. Not only, so she, you had the option of living in, on the economy. So she said she was going to, so we lived in this little town called Rushden, about maybe 20 miles from the base. We were the only blacks, the only Americans. And it was the first time I really became aware of myself as an American. Prior to that, I was an African American. And that was my whole context, you know, a subculture of a large culture. Of course, you know, this is during the height of the Civil Rights Movement, 67, you know. And so there's a whole lot going on. So you don't really feel connected to the larger society. But when you go overseas, the first thing, well, at least in England, they call you a Yank. And, you know, I mean, it just, that somebody would think of me that way was just, all, you know, altering my perception of the world, literally. Because they were the first white people to see me as, see my nationality first. They did, were aware that I was black, but first I was American, and then I was black. I went to places in England. I would never go, and when, back in the 60s, I would have never gone into an all-white bar. In Brooklyn. I'm not talking about the South. I'm talking about certain parts of Brooklyn. But I did, you know, without any, you know, apprehension. And it had to, like, really, when I came back to the States, I had to, like, readjust, you know. Like, you can't, no, you can't, this is not England. This is not the Midlands. You can't go into that Irish bar. You know, right. But anyway, when I came back, back in, so that's 71, I started, I came back to, I had gone to school in Maryland, a small historical black college called Morgan State. And then I transferred back to New York in the early 70s. And that's when I became involved with Weeksville. I started working, as I said before, for Bronx Community College, which was a unit of City University, as a media, as an AV person. And I started my own sort of on the side film company, I made you know, educational films and videos for the school, and then I made mostly African-American documentaries for myself. I had a partner, a guy who's my mentor, his name is Bob Knight, and he kind of really taught me pretty much everything I knew or have known about film. So I guess this was, what, 70, I forget what, this was around, just before Alex Haley came out with Roots, around that time. So I guess this is like mid-70s, 75, 76. Weeksville got a grant to do an exhibit, to make an exhibit from the New York State Council on the Arts. I helped write the exhibit, and there was going to be a film as part of the exhibit. So I made this film called Weeksville Save the Memories of Self, which is the first film about Weeksville. So that's about 76. And it went on to win the National Trust for Historic Preservation Student Film Award, which I was very proud of. And I wasn't even, I think maybe I was 20, 21 years old. And there were no black filmmakers that I knew of back then. I mean, and Spike Lee obviously wasn't around. And Gordon Parks was probably the only major film, but I didn't know any small people that were doing documentaries like I was. And so through my involvement with the film, and then I think after that, they asked me to be on the board. And so in the mid-70s, I said right after I made the film, I joined the board of directors. And I was on the board of directors until I left New York in 89. So I say from about 76, 77 to 89, I was on the board of directors. We showed the film, the exhibit, and the film opened at the Met. They had a community museum, and so we opened the exhibit, and I showed the film there. And it's been shown a lot of places on PBS. There was a fundraiser that we did with Alex Haley at the Waldorf back in. So I guess that's. I was at Pratt back then. So maybe 80. And so, you know, that's pretty much, you know, I was involved with the number of the fundraisers and, you know, the film. And then when they restored the houses, I moved in as sort of a security person, you know. Back, you know, it was a work in progress, and, you know, we were concerned about people, you know, breaking in and stealing the copper pipes, and, you know, because it was, you know, it was a museum, and there wasn't anybody, like, living there, so I moved up to the top floor just so that, you know, we could protect the building as they were being restored. The same people that did the restoration for South Street Seaport did ours. I forget the name of the company, but it was the same people. It took about 2 or 3 years to restore the houses. Because it was a restoration as opposed to a renovation, so they wanted to do it with the same types of materials and stuff that were used in the original house. So it took a lot longer than it would be if they just, you know, went in and did it. And then they did the houses at how they looked at different periods in time. So, you know, that was been pretty much my connection with Weeksville, you know, started at, you know, with the film, you know, well, with my mom, and then, you know, with the film, and then on the board of directors, and then just a supporter, you know. I think I did probably lead the board before I left New York, but I was always, you know, a supporter whenever they needed something and they needed some videos. I think I shot a couple of, I was the videographer of record there. Whenever we had an event, they would call me and I'd come and I'd videotape it. Videotaped some really, you know, interesting people: John Henry Clark, Dr. Ben Shokanen, Lynn Jeffries, Gil Noble. We used to have a fundraiser, and they would, you know, have a speaker, and I was usually the one that videotaped the guest speaker. So I guess in a nutshell, that's kind of been my involvement with Geeksville.
I've been taking notes while you've been talking. I'd love to go back and get more details about each one.
Okay.
Just because that's one of the great things about oral history is we can go so much deeper than just, you know, the records usually are, and I'll mine your memories a little bit. One of the first things that jumped out to me is you spent so much time in museums as a kid. I wanted to get your thoughts on what kind of view of history you got from being in these museums, and then how the way museums have been curated over the decades has kind of changed, in your opinion.
Well, of course, going to the Met and to the Museum of Natural History, it was mostly a Eurocentric, you know, view of the world. And I think that's one of the things that motivated Mother and me later on, is that, you know, there was another story to be told here, and that it wasn't being told, and that we needed, in order for us to do that, we needed to build our own institutions, and hence, we could.
As your mom started to do all this research on Weeksville and uncovering things, do you have memories, even before it got published in the New York Times article, about her talking to you about it, or
because
she got really excited
her best
about
friend
something?
Who, for a long time, we lived in the same building. We lived on Putnam Avenue between Lewis and Stuyvesant. Well, my grandparents bought the house in the late 40s, right after the war. And my mother and my brother and I moved in after my mother and father separated. So I guess that was early, maybe mid-50s. Because I was still in grammar school, grade school. So I'd say maybe 56, 57, we moved on Putnam Avenue. And when she got involved in it, it was sort of, you know, listening to conversations over the dinner table with her and her best friend was a woman named Dolores McCullough, who was also one of the founding members of the Weeksville Society. And so it was just, you know, like dinner table discussions. You know, that's how I really, before the, you know. And I knew they were involved. And like I said, my mother, I mean, she was like a real avid researcher. I mean, she discovered who was the first black person in New York, a guy named Francisco during the time of the Dutch. And she, you know, she loved, and when she went to England, she did research in the colonial records to find out, you know, whether black people in New York before it was New York, when it was Amsterdam, and yes, you know, they were. So those are the kind of things that she would talk about, you know, in our discussions back then. You know, she would write letters, you know, because I was in school and she was overseas. So that's kind of, you know, yeah, before the Times article, it was just, you know, dinner table discussion, you know, very casual, and just listening to her and my aunt, what I call my Aunt Bunny, talk about. So, yeah, I mean, it was family discussion.
Now, they started all this research before the Hunter Fly Roadhouses were even found.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
That's how they found the Hunter Roadhouses.
Yeah.
The research started, as I said before, as a class on ethnic contributions. And it's really interesting how they found the houses, because they knew that they were in that, you know, they saw on the map, this on an old map, Weeksville. But, you know, when they came and laid down the grid, I mean, all of that was obliterated. And so there was a friend named Joe Haynes, who was a pilot. And Joe flew over the area, and then they discovered a street that went against the grid. And then they came down, and that's how they discovered the houses. But yeah, they knew that Weeksville was in that area. They had a office in I think it was Kingsborough Houses, which is a housing projects in Brooklyn. So yeah, Weeksville existed and was an entity. Well, they called it originally the Society for the Preservation of Weeksville and Bedford-Stuyvesant History. That was the original name. Now it's just the Weeksville History Center. And yeah, so the society was in existence for a number of years before they found the houses.
Yeah. So tell me about when they found the houses. I mean, those dinner time conversations must have gotten pretty animated. And
yeah. How did that change things? Yeah, because the houses were like in real dire shape because, you know, they hadn't, you know, nothing had been done to them. They were built in. We are estimating, there's no official record, and we think now that the houses were actually built somewhere else and then moved there. Yeah, but the eight houses, the workmanship, and you know, from the archaeological work that had been done on the houses, they estimate they were built in the 1840s. And so when we discovered them, that was the 60s. And so, you know, there are houses back, and they were like, you know, very simple wood frame houses. So we actually eventually, one of the houses someone was living in, Bernice Jenkins. She lived in the house that fronted on Pacific Street. And the houses that fronted on Hunter Fly Road were in pretty bad shape. So we eventually had to tend them over to keep them from deteriorating until we could get the money to restore them. So, yeah, to answer to your question, yeah. The society had started first on the just on the concept that this was a black community. There was a black community there prior, a free black community there prior to emancipation, and so that was the real buzz that there was a free black community in New York prior to the Emancipation Proclamation, because slavery was, you know, at the beginning of the America, slavery was legal in all states, North and South. So you know, gradually over the years, you know, emancipation was, you know, introduced on a state level in most of the states above the Mason-Dixon line. So it was just really interesting. You know, it was during an age of what I consider, I'm not exactly sure what people will call it then, but we called it back then Black Consciousness Movement. You know, and it was about one, discovering what our real history was; two, about having pride in being black instead of it seeing it as a derogatory state. You know, people got, I got a big afro, and, you know, and people started changing their names and giving their kids African names and wearing dashikis, and it was all part of that whole, like I said, you know, Black Consciousness Movement.
And reengaging with the history was.
Was part of that, yeah. You know, I discovered people like John Henry Clark and Dr. Ben Jokanen, who were, you know, African-American scholars. And they would often speak at events that we had. And so it was the beginning of a new, you know, form of consciousness. And then, you know, you begin to understand not so much that it was a distortion by exclusion. Instead of necessarily saying things, negative things, you just weren't mentioned at all, you know. And so, and then when you begin to find out, I mean, even today, as I consider myself to be a student of African American history, and almost every day I discover a new story about something that I didn't know prior to this. So, you know, there's, you know, so much history to be discovered still at this point. I mean, we just sort of really scratched the surface in terms of particularly history as it relates to the time prior to emancipation. I mean, it's just really a void in terms of African-American history. So it's been, you know, it's been really exciting because I still, you know, do that. I do tours, walking tours.
In Atlanta. Oh, Brooklyn?
No.
Oh.
Well, I am. I'm planning to, but I live in Atlanta, and we just got a, there's this big project in Atlanta called the Beltline. It's like High Line here in New York, except it's mostly below ground level, street level. And it's an old railroad track that used to circle Atlanta. And back in the 60s, it was abandoned. And then they, about 10 years ago, they sort of rediscovered it and turned it into this pedestrian bike path and at some future date, light rail. And so my company just got a, and they just finished a section in the neighborhood I live in, which reminds me very much of Brooklyn and Bed-Stuy. Both in terms of the people and in terms of the social political activity that's going on now. I mean, it's sort of like 10 years behind Brooklyn. I mean, because of this construction, there are these huge gentrification pressures that are now rocking the community. Now, the only difference in Atlanta is that the neighborhood that I lived in, and the same thing goes, it really is true for Brooklyn and Bed-Stuy. The gentrification, revitalization, or the change in Brooklyn, started back when my grandparents bought those houses, because that was an all-white community when they purchased those houses. They purchased it from an Italian family back in the late 40s. And then, of course, what happened back in those days, really interesting, is that once one black family moved in, there was this white flight. And then there was this thing called blockbusting, where unscrupulous real estate people would install a black person in a community knowing what kind of impact it would have on all the white people. And then they would buy up all the houses as the white people would flee at depressed prices, and then turn around and sell them at inflated prices to the new blacks that moved in. So that was what was happening in Bed-Stuy in the 40s and 50s. By the time I was a teenager, Bed-Stuy was like 99.9% black, right? And so I left in 89, and now I would say maybe Bed-Stuy is maybe 75% black, which is still predominantly black, but it's also been a huge increase in the white population. I mean, there were no white people in Bed-Stuy when I was growing up. I mean, none. I mean, the only people, white people you would see in Bed-Stuy is the mailman and police and the fire department. And if you saw somebody else that wasn't, you know, black there, you know, it was real. You noticed it. It was just that obvious. Now it's just, you know, I remember coming home, well, I guess I still call New York home, coming back to New York maybe about 4 or 5 years ago and getting off at the station where I lived. And I saw all these white people getting off. It's like, what is going on here? I mean, it's a neighborhood that I wouldn't go into when I was a kid. I mean, they were moving there. I guess they didn't know any better. And so now the same thing is happening in the community I live in Atlanta. It's called West End. And because of this new belt line that they bought in, you know, housing prices have really skyrocketed. But the difference is that, and it's not so much a difference, the same thing is that the change in the West End actually started maybe 20 years earlier. That's when that neighborhood started to change from predominantly white to predominantly black. And because the AU Center, the Atlanta University Center, Morehouse Spelman, are like right across, are our neighbors. A lot of faculty, staff, and students moved into the neighborhood. So it wasn't, it was more of a upper middle class white, black gentrification as opposed to, you know, the houses being, you know, broken up into rooming houses and stuff. So I work out of a museum called the Hammonds House Museum. And the name's Hammonds is from a doctor who bought the house back in 79. It took him 5 years to restore the house to its original condition. The house was originally built, we think, we don't have accurate records, but about 1870. And he restored it back to the condition it was when it was first built. So that's when it started. And so a lot of black like I said, teachers, faculty members, staff members, you know, students, once they graduated, you know, they moved into the neighborhood. A lot of people, a lot of people who lived in, a lot of black families who lived in the North, the houses were so cheap down there back in those days that they would actually buy a house instead of putting their kid on campus and paying dorm fees. They would buy a house, install their kid there, renovate the house, rent out the rest of the rooms to other students, and then their kid would wind up living there rent free. And then I know of at least three or four examples of that. As when the kids graduated, the parents moved into the house, and the kids, they wanted to go back to New York. And the parents said, later for New York, you know, I'm tired of New York. They, you know, so they stayed in Atlanta. Their kids went back to New York. And then that's how that neighborhood became. And then so that was the first wave, black wave. And that happened, I would say, like I said, in the late 70s, early 80s. And then around 08, after the last market crash, there was another wave of mostly black families, professionals that moved into the neighborhood. Again, the houses, you could still get a three, four bedroom house on a quarter acre lot for $100,000, $75,000. And so there was a huge influx of young, intact black families, professional families. With kids. That was another thing, that the community didn't have any kids because the school sucked. And, you know, it just wasn't considered a family community. But I'd say since 08, maybe there's been a 300-400% increase. A lot of them homeschooled their kids. And then they also opened up two charter schools in the neighborhood. So either they send their kids to the charter schools or they homeschool them. And so about 2 years ago, so most of these, I would say a wave. There was about a dozen families that moved from Texas together as a group. And they all settled in the West End and they started a church in the community.
Not to interrupt, but to take it back to Brooklyn.
Yeah, okay.
That's all right. I mean, it's fascinating, but to take it back.
Well, the analogies, the same things that are happening in Brooklyn are happening.
How were you seeing this
and
happening?
And so it's just almost like deja vu.
Yeah.
You know, the same things that happened in Brooklyn are now happening in this community that I live in.
Right. So talk to me. You were saying that the revitalization of the black community in Bed-Stuy kind of started with this homeownership thing with, you know, your grandparents moving in.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was this manufactured depression of the value of the houses. Mm-hmm. And then what picked up after that?
Well, I think those houses pretty much stayed the same for the whole time I was there. I mean, on the block that I lived at on Putnam Avenue between Lewis and Stuyvesant, I would say 80-90% of the people owned those brownstones. And they're incredible, beautiful brownstones. I mean, you Brooklyn, you know. I think Bed-Stuy has some of the best brownstones in the city still today, and the most. I mean, you can go block after block after block of just these really incredible brownstones. And the house we lived in had never been broken up into apartments because when we bought it from a private family. There was a chapel in the house. Yeah. Where they did their own christenings in the house with a little thing where they put the water where you could christen the child. So they had a chapel down in what I guess was where me and my brother's room was what was the servants' quarters, basically. And then there was the chapel, and then the kitchen. And we had a backyard with a cherry tree in it. And this incredible woodwork. I mean, it's just, I hated it as a kid because that was my job, was to dust. And, you know, it was all this very ornate, very hand-carved, you know, and you had to get in, you know, my grandfather was, you know, he'd come by and do one of these numbers, you know.
Rub it with his face.
Yeah, I had to check. I mean, and you had to, you know, it had these little curly cues and stuff, and you had to get in there. And that was our job. I mean, and it was all wood paneling. The whole house was these cherry wood staircases and the wood paneling, you know, like this with the molding, but everything below it was wood. And these huge French wooden doors. It was a beautiful house. I mean, still to this day, it's a beautiful house.
It's still in the family?
No. But it's in a black... Okay, when we... It has to do with that migration I was telling you about. So when my grandparents retired, they moved back to North Carolina. They sold the house to a black family. So this is, what, 67, 68?
Okay.
I'm in college. My mother's overseas, so there's really nobody there. And they wanted to get out of New York. At least my grandfather wanted to get out of New York. I don't know about my grandmother. But so he sold it to a friend of his who still owns it. This is back. So they bought the house in 67. And it was a fraternity. My grandfather was in some, I don't know, Masons or something. And this is one of his fraternity brothers. And he had seven boys. And he couldn't find an apartment. No one would rent to him. I mean, from like 7 to 13, you know, I mean... Seven teenage boys there. So he couldn't find out. So my grandfather. And I think he sold a house in 67, maybe for $20,000. But he probably only paid 10 for it. So he thought he was, you know, he doubled. So he thought. And then I think also it was that it was a sorority. He probably could have gotten a little bit more for it. But in 67, that was, you know, that was probably an average price for a house like that. And plus, like I said, he probably gave the guy a break. Now the house is probably worth $1.5 million. You know, I've been in the house, you know, fairly recently, a couple of years ago. When I go to New York, I always go by and see the family just to see the house because so many really incredible memories there. And they, you know, actually they've improved it because my grandfather did a lot of what did my mother call it, bootleg kind of stuff in the house. You know, I mean he. And it was, I guess people now would call it tacky and back then. Now it's folk art, you know. He would take old appliances and repurpose them. I remember when the first TVs came out, it was way before your time, the TV tubes, the tubes were circular. They weren't square. And so when they finally came out with square TVs, he bought a, you know, square TV. And then he took the old TV and took the picture tube out of it and put a candelabra in it. And, you know, back in those days, they made very beautiful cabinetry. And, you know, those are the kind of things he did. My mother hated and my grandmother hated that kind of stuff, but that's, you know. So the house was full of that kind of, you know, what we call folk art now. But they kept the, you know, but all the, you know, the, all the, you know, the woodwork and the molding. And it had those, you know, the wet ceilings with all the, you know, decorations in it and a crystal chandelier. So it was a beautiful home. It was always kept immaculate. I mean, there were certain rooms we just couldn't even go into as kids, you know. And it had the plastic seat covers. Which they'd take off when guests came, you know. And it was a family house. My grandparents lived on the first floor and the parlor floor. And then me and my brother and my mother lived on the third floor. And then the woman I was referring to was my mother's best friend, which I call Aunt Bunny. She lived on the fourth floor. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever, you know, there were no locked doors. And I could, one day I might be eating dinner with my grandmother. Next day I might be eating dinner at my mother's. And then the next day I might be eating dinner up at Aunt Bunny's house. It was that kind of atmosphere.
So they were living together and they signed up for their class?
Together, yeah. Together. They were best friends since he went from the moment she moved into the house, which was... So they must have known each other for... She died recently, a couple of years ago. So, God, what am I? I'm 67. They must have known each other for over 50. Because when they met, I was a little kid. So they must have known each other almost maybe 60 years. And, you know, they traveled all over the world together. You know, once my mother, you know, was overseas, she would come visit her when she was in England. And then even when she came back, they would go on trips all over the world together. I remember, well, back in the 70s, when we, you know, nobody heard of bed and breakfasts in the States. And they would go to Europe and they would, you know, stay in bed and breakfasts all over Europe. And they would go by themselves, just those two. They went to Africa, all over, Alaska, all over. So, and they were like real, you know, real tight. And she was, you know, like family. I mean, I called her Aunt Bunny, and she, when she introduced me, this is my nephew, Robert, you know. And it was like that, you know. She passed about 2 or 3 years ago. But, you know, that was the kind of, you know, that was the kind of family attitude, family. And I see that. I have a friend who is originally from New York, but we didn't meet until we were down in Atlanta. And he moved back to New York, and he lives in a very similar situation. It's a three-generation house. And his grandkids, well, the woman he married, her grandkids, they'll be popping up unannounced, you know. But it's a, it was a really incredible lifestyle, you know. And I never really, we weren't poor, no. I mean, I always cringed at these depictions of black families where there was all this crisis and, you know, and they were worried about white people. And we, I mean, I really didn't, I thought I lived the average American life. I never wanted for anything. I mean, materially or otherwise. I my mother always, you know, beginning of the year, she took me in and, you know, bought me new clothes for school, for Easter and all that. She always had a good job. She worked for the city, for rent control. And of course we lived in with my grandparents, and so I don't think we ever got a rent increase. I think she paid the same amount, maybe $100 a month for 20 years, you know, as her salary increased, you know. And I remember one time, I remember my aunt telling me the story that my grandfather came up and he was very sad. And he was telling my mom, he said, I'm going to have to raise your rent, like $20. And she had been paying like $100 for like 67 years, you know, and she had a really good, she was a court stenographer. And so we lived rather well. I remember my mother would go she was an excellent seamstress, and she would make all of her clothes. And she would go to like Bergdorf's and Bloomingdale's and places like that and look at the clothes, right? And she would say, they're charging this much for that? This is only $20 worth of material. I can do this. And then she would, you know, she'd get it. Because, you know, they had knockoff patterns, you know. So, you know, she would go to these fancy department stores, look at what they have, you know, check, you know, unzip it, look at it and see how it was made. And she would go home and make it. And, you know, so she was always dressed to the T, and people, I guess, thought that that's all she did with her money was buy clothes, but, it, you know, she made all that stuff. And I mean, I'm talking about, in, back in those days, a $200, $300 dress was a fortune. And so she would make it for, like, maybe $20, $30 worth of material, and, you know, and maybe a week of labor. And so she was always dressed to the max. And made sure that we were also. I hated it, of course, as a kid. You know, she would drag us, you know, to the department stores and try clothes on for us. I mean, that was one of the most excruciating. But we were always dressed out. And I never forget one time I was playing sandlot football and I got hurt. And I guess my coaches wanted to make sure my parents weren't going to sue them. So they came by the house to check on me. I had a dislocated shoulder. And there was these two white guys, you know. And you could tell when they walked in the house, they were like stunned. I don't know what they expected to find, but they were like, mouth opened, eyes aghast. When I was looking at them, I'm like, what are you looking at? And then it dawned on me that they really, you know, there's certain periods in your life when you're like a light bulb goes on in your house, in your head, and say, oh, And not until that happened did I begin to realize that the perceptions and the images that they were projecting of black people were not accurate. And that white people was, you know, when they actually met somebody that was black and saw how we live, they were stunned. They didn't, you know, they thought we all lived in shacks or in the ghetto or in, you know, in these horrible conditions. And it wasn't like, and everybody on my block lived like this. We weren't the exceptions. Like I said, 70% of the people, 80, maybe 90% of the people owned there were no absentee landlords on my block. They were either people who owned those houses and then they rented it out, or they were like us where they were family occupied by 3-4 generations. And the whole time I was there, it's like that. It was like that. And I think it's pretty much like that now because, fortunately, like myself and, you know, most of my contemporaries, they understood the value because they had professional parents who told them, you know, hey, this is, you know, don't sell, you know. And like I said, there were 3 generations that lived in the house. And most of them, you know, when I go back to, like, the person that we sold the house to in 67 is still there. Their kids have moved other places because oftentimes children don't really appreciate what they grew up in. But they, well, what's interesting, though, is that, so this is a 4-story brownstone, mm-hmm. right? So even though all the kids don't live there, they all have apartments there. So when they come back to New York, you know, they have a place to stay. Because I wanted to, you know, I was, you know, when I came back to New York, I said, man, maybe I'll go over there and I could stay, you know, in the old, you know, old homestead. That would be wonderful. So I went, they were the name of the family, the Cherries. And so I, you know, I said, well, can I rent a room for you when I come back? He said, no, they all, you know, the kids got along. So, you know, it was a lower middle class, you know, upbringing. You know, like I said, I never considered myself to be poor. I never wanted for, you know, I didn't get the best of everything. You know, I didn't get the top sneaker. I might have got what we call skips back in the day. You could get Converses with a big sneaker back in those days, and they cost $10. And my mother said, I'm not paying $10 for sneakers.
Yeah. Do you want me to pause this for you?
No. I love that feature.
This scam.
Let me turn this.
That would be great. You're making me think of a couple of different things all at once.
Go ahead.
One is, you know, earlier you talked about, you know, the sins of omission in history, and, you know, it's not just that they said life was terrible before emancipation. They just didn't even talk about these communities that were, you know, middle class communities, upper middle class, educated landowning communities. Mm-hmm. So it's that kind of omission that leads your white neighbors to come over and have no idea, to have never even imagined that there could be a middle class black family with a good quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
So as your mom and your aunt are unearthing this history of Weeksville, it's the past in conversation with the present in a way that they want to inform and re-inform the neighborhood. So, you know, moving forward from that moment, what did they do for community outreach, and how did you see that impacting people's imaginations of themselves and of the neighborhood when they started to learn about Weeksville's history?
Well, you know, I think, as I said before, this was all happening in a broader social context of, you know, civil rights movement, black consciousness, black power, black pride, the rediscovery of not only African American but African history. Weeksville, we did a lot of, you know, we had the annual luncheon, which was fairly well attended, and then we would, you know, there was this thing called the Weeksville Lady. We found a picture of a woman from the period dressed in this really nice, you know, outfit. And so we had somebody make a similar outfit to what the woman had. It was an old Guattara type photograph, probably around 1860s, of this really finely dressed black woman. And so we, like I said, we copied the dress, and there was a woman that would wear it, and we called her the Weeksville Lady. And she would go to schools and talk about, you know, Weeksville and stuff like that. And whenever they had school fairs, we did an archaeological, how we found that photograph is that we did an archaeological project. There was a housing development across the street from where our original office was, and they were tearing those houses down to build new housing. And so we went to the city because we knew that was where the heart of Weeksville was. So we went to the city and asked for permission to do a dig before they built the new houses. And we found a treasure. We found an old well. And, you know, usually those old wells are full of what was back then garbage, which are now artifacts. And so we found a lot of old Bibles, old photographs, all kinds of stuff. So that was kind of what was, you know, our main outreach, mostly in schools. There was like a Boy Scout troop that came over. The dig was a major outreach because people could see people digging. And, you know, that in a black community, you see people digging in a place. I mean, obviously people go, what are you, you know, what are you looking for? So that, because that went on for a couple of months. And in order to do that, we had to make a presentation at City Hall to get permission.
This was around 68?
Yeah, so this is 60, yeah, late 60s, early 70s.
Because there was another one in the early 70s, another archaeological.
Well, I'm trying to think. This was the one for what was on Bergen Street. So I might have been, I might be the one I'm talking about. I know there was the one where we found most of the stuff, and that was probably early 70s, so it was probably okay. That one.
The one where the Boy Scouts got involved.
Yeah.
All right, so that's the
70s
one.
Yeah. So that was, you know, and then we would, you know, like I said, the Weeksville lady would go to schools, and there was the Weeksville school. So there was actually a school called elementary school that was the Weeksville school, and there was a woman named Marguerite Thompson, no relation to me, who was from Bank Street School, and she started a program there, and so we had a lot of artifacts there, and of course the school was named Weeksville, and she, you know, made a point of integrating the knowledge of the school into the community, the knowledge of the community into that school, if it wasn't, you know, the broader context. But that was again around the time when, you know, students were demanding black studies and, you know, and that history, black history courses be taught, and, you know, that there be more faculty, you know, black faculty at school. So there was a whole sea change, you know, at least in New York around that time. And we, you know, had our niche in it. Most of the outreach were to kids in elementary schools. And like I said, but you had a whole school named Weeksville School with a curriculum that was based on that, all the research that we had done. We had actually took some of the artifacts and took them to the school, and there was a room in the school with, you know, with these pictures of, you know, middle-class black people back in the 50s and 1850s and 1860s. So that was mostly how our reach. And then the film, like I said, that I did was shown in a lot of places. So between our, physical outreach, the school and the film were probably a main reach. So we were fairly well-known in Brooklyn, you know, back in those days and to this day.
Tell me more about the archaeological dig. Do you have any particular memories from it?
I think that was during the time I was probably, if it was the early 70s, I might have been in school. I wasn't involved with the dig.
Oh, 78 to 82 is what I wrote down here.
70 what?
78 to 82.
I wasn't involved in the dig.
Okay.
I wasn't. I made the film. And then I had, you know, I had kind of started a film. I was working at Pratt probably by then. 78? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I started at Pratt in 78. Yeah. And I also started a film company. And that was around the time we were very busy. I mean, in addition to doing documentaries, we did a film called The Sermon, which was about the organization of the National Black United Front, which was a organization that was started by a guy named Herbert Daughtry back, you know, around a police killing of an unarmed black man. Some things never change. And so that was a whole movement. The National Black United Black Front became a national organization around police violence back in the around that time, late 70s, early 80s. And we did a documentary about that whole movement. We did a that was around the time when Grenada was invaded. We did an interview with this guy who was the finance minister of Grenada about the invasion, and we did a lot of documentaries on black life, and then we also did a lot of music videos. That was sort of kind of paid the rent, as you would say. It was a really good, good lifestyle. And I had a full-time job. I was the director of media services at Pratt Institute. And then I had, which paid a decent salary. And then I had this production company, Insight Video Productions. And, you know, we made films and videos, you know, either African-American documentaries or music videos. But I really didn't get a whole lot involved with the dig. I was kind of really occupied with other. I was doing, you know, when they would call me to come in, I would come, I would maybe shoot some video of them doing the dig. But I wasn't physically involved in
it. Talk to me about being the security guard at the house then. What was it like living there? I'd love just like a tour of the inside of the house.
Well,
what it was like living there, your adventures in the evenings, whatever you got.
Only one of the houses. The houses were in the midst of being renovated. So I lived in the house on Bergen Street. That was the one that was the most livable. I mean, people had actually lived in it, you know, for quite some time. And then the Jenkins family, who had lived there for maybe 20, 30 years, sold it to Weeksville. And then Weeksville purchased the house. And then our office was downstairs on the first floor. And there was an apartment above that, and I lived there. The house was, you know, old wooden drafty house, and you know you had rodents running through it. So I got a cat, and then the cat got fleas. I had to get rid of the cat. it was something else. I moved there in from a fairly nice apartment in a brownstone, you know, thinking I would save some money because, you know, I wouldn't pay any rent. But I couldn't get all my furniture. I had this, somebody had given me this really fabulous couch. I couldn't get it up the steps. So it was an adventure. It was, you know, because the house was under construction as I was living in it. It was probably kind of, you know, holy and drafty. I eventually got a dog because I was, you know, for security reasons. I'll never forget one day. I left this chicken out to defrost, and the dog ate it. I mean, a whole chicken, a whole raw chicken. I came back to the house, and, you know, he usually, you know, when I come back to the house, the dog is usually at the door jumping. And I came to the door, and the dog was nowhere to be found. And so I went, and I saw him. She was slinking in a corner. I said, what? And then the only thing that was left of the chicken was the wrapper. I started burst out laughing, and I was mad, but it was so funny. I couldn't hit it. You got me on that one. You're not eating no dinner tonight. You got mine. But it was, and then my daughter was very young at that time. She would come to stay with me, and it was quite an adventure. I lived there for maybe about a year and a half, something like that.
And the other houses that weren't livable, were they still covered?
Yeah, they were still covered. They were in the midst of renovation. I mean, they were, one, as they untinned them, there were a couple that were still, there were two, when I was there, two of the houses were tinned, and one of them was in the process of renovation. And one of the things that we would do, that I would do, is I'd come by and, you know, shoot a little bit, then come back a couple of weeks later, shoot a little bit so that you could see them. you know, the progress. But it was, yeah, it was an adventure. That, I mean, that whole, that was a kind of rough neighborhood. It still is kind of rough neighborhood. It was even rougher back then. You know, but it was interesting. It was very interesting living there.
Were you ever called upon to act as a security guard? I mean, that was part of your reason for being there.
No, not really. I think once people realized that there was someone living there and that he had a big dog, we didn't have any real... No one that I... There were no break-ins while I was there, you know, or no attempted break-ins while I was there. You know, of course, like, when I wasn't there, the dog was there. I had a big German Shepherd. And, he was a real punk, but people didn't know that. I mean, somebody had actually broken the house, he probably would have ran the other way. But, I mean, the barking, you know, got kept people away.
Yeah. My mom grew up in a house that was like a 1800s mess, and all the things they had to figure out about, like, plumbing and hardware, and, you know, you open up one wall, and it's like, what is even in there? So I can only imagine what it's like living in an old house while it's being renovated. What were some of the things people were finding, or like, what did you have to rig up to make it livable?
Like I said, the house that we lived in, people had been living in for a while, so mm-hmm. they had done a lot to it, and it was livable, you know, and they had running water and all that. So it wasn't any kind of real physical challenges. It was more the neighborhood. Oh, okay. And it was drafty, of course, you know, and then you had, you know, rodents running in and out, because there were big holes every time, you know, I'd patch one and then there'd be another one somewhere else. But that was it. I mean, and then, you know, of course, since there was an office downstairs, you know, there was always something, you know, going on, people having meetings or, I never, you know, and people, it was a very close-knit group of folks, because when they would have meetings, I'd cook dinner and I'd bring dinner down and, you know, feed people and whatnot. So it was pretty cool.
You were on the board at that time?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what were you guys, how were you raising money for this massive renovation? And
grants.
Lots of writing grants.
Yeah. We got money from the National Trust for the grants, for the restoration. National Trust for Historic Preservation, I think, gave that. And for a lot of the outreach for the film, we got a grant from the New York State Council of the Arts. So it was mostly, we did do some, like I said, we had a major fundraiser every year. But most, I would say 80-90% of the money was from grants from the Department of Cultural Affairs and places like that. And Joan was a big fundraiser too. I mean, Joan Maynard, who was the first executive director. And she was a real go-getter. I mean, there was a lot of, you know, like $25, $30 donations from people in the community, you know, $50, $100 here or there. And that was mostly, you know, from Joan Strongarm and people. So that was pretty much, you know, I would say maybe 10, 20% of our budget was donations and then the rest were grants.
Tell me about Joan.
You know, if there was, I think every institution, if it's going to have a history, has to have a Joan Maynard. You know, somebody who just dedicates their whole life. They don't have any children. Well, her one child was grown. She wasn't married. And she really didn't have a life other than in Weeksville. I mean, for an institution like that, to prosper, it needs somebody that's willing to devote their life to it. And that's pretty much what she did. I mean, it was like Joan and Weeksville were synonymous, you know. She slept, ate, breathed Weeksville. And then when she was selected to the board of directors for the National Trust, that opened up a lot of doors for us. And she was just always willing to come and talk about preservation and history. To the point where she became almost an institution to herself, and all of that rubbed off on Weeksville, you know. She was really the Weeksville lady, even without the costume, you know what I mean? When you thought of Weeksville, you thought of Joan. And then, you know, that was her from an institutional point of view. I knew her, of course, personally, and we were friends, and she was a mentor to me. The film that I did for Weeksville was my first major production. So she was sort of, you know, she was responsible for, you know, for that. And she was just a very kind, loving person. She was basically an artist by profession. She was a graphic artist. But once she got involved with Weeksville, that kind of went by the wayside. And she devoted all her energies, efforts to Weeksville. She was just, I mean, just, like I said, you know those people you say, get a life? that was her life. And she, I don't ever remember her having a boyfriend or, you know, a man in her life. I mean, for 20 years, maybe more. Like I said, her child, she had a son, but he was a grown man by the time she got involved with Weeksville.
How did she get involved with Weeksville?
I think she came to a meeting once, and she just, you know, like a lot of people, you know, just fell in love with the idea and the concept. Like I said, it was around the time when, you know, black people were discovering that we did have a history here in this country and that it was interesting and fascinating. And it was all new and fresh, and it still, to me, is new and fresh, but there's still so much that hasn't been told. So I think she came to one of our outreach, you know, efforts, and then, you know, she started as a volunteer, and the next thing I knew she was, you know, being a starving artist, you know, I mean, it wasn't too much of, you know, being a museum director was a step up. You know, there were days when, you know, I mean, in months and weeks when, you know, we couldn't pay her. Yeah. And so, you know, then she went back to doing her artist thing. So, I mean, a person with a family would have never, they wouldn't have stepped, I mean, they couldn't have hung. It had to be somebody like June. And you know, when you talk about somebody being all in, Joan was all in. And like I said, she just had that kind of personality, very soft-spoken, but very intense at the same time. And so you could feel the intensity of what she thought about Weeksville and this whole movement of African-American history in a very quiet but methodical and intense way. And she was, you know, like I said, a very personal, very, very kind, giving person. Very kind, giving person, very, you know, into Weeksville and what it meant.
Tell me something that you learned from her, since she was kind of a mentor.
She always had the saying, you catch more flies with honey than you do with vinegar. And that was, you know, you can like nice people to death. You know, like, you know, I mean, how could you say no to this sweet little lady? You know, who's just like, well, we really, you know, we could use this and we could use that. And we did, you know, I mean, she would just break your, almost, I wouldn't say break your heart, but make you feel like, oh, what do you need? What can I give you? I mean, by the time she got finished, she was like, you know, we were looking for things to give her, you know. She just made it sound so alluring, you know, and she was so, and I think people sensed her dedication, and that sense of dedication went a long way to people saying that they would support them. As if she's, you know, this nice little lady is that intense about it, and she can, and she was able, you know, she really educated herself, so she could talk about it, you know, authoritatively, but also with passion and authority. And with a sense of, why don't you come help me do this? You know, like, boy, this is exciting. Don't you want to be part of this? You know, she enlisted, you know, she had this, when she talked about Weeksville, I mean, it would be like, I mean, she would light up and she could transmit that intensity to other people in a way that few people that I know could sense. I think she taught me that you could, like I said, that whole phrase, you catch more flies with honey. So even if people are mean to you and they're not really nice, you can nice them to death. You can make them feel guilty about being mean to you by just being, just nice. And I mean, she wasn't a pushover, but you know, I can't ever remember her raising her voice at anyone. I mean, I wasn't with her 24/7, but even when she, you know, and you knew she was upset about something, she would still talk in this very measured tone and try, you know, well, you know, I'm sorry you think that way, but you know, she was always very pleasant. But you know, she was really intense and single track about Weeksville. And like I said, I think any institution that's going to be an institution has to have at least one Joe Maynard.
At least one.
At least one. You know, some people are lucky and they have more than one, but you need at least one. Somebody that's willing to give up everything for it, and to encourage other people, maybe not to give up everything, but to give up something for it. You know, even if they couldn't match her intensity, they caught the fire. So she was, you know, that were my impressions of her. That's what she taught me about how to deal with people, even people who are unpleasant or maybe have designs that are not in tune with yours, is to always be pleasant. And you get more out of it than trying to batter. And I guess part a lot of it was because she was a little tiny woman, you know. And, you know, she really didn't have any physical power, but she had this spiritual, emotional, intellectual power that made up for her lack of physical stature.
This is making me wonder about, you know, the early days of the board, those people who caught the fire. Like, what was it like? What were some of the early challenges? How did you figure out those hurdles? What were the interpersonal dynamics? What can you tell me about that?
Well, you know, I think there's always a level of tension between staff and board.
Okay.
You know, I mean, the board probably thinking that they need to micromanage, and then, you know, the staff, you know, resenting the micromanagement. But I think one of the things that saved or made Weeksville what it is that the board was like, we were all friends. Now, I was the baby at a lot. Most of them were my mother's contemporaries. They were like 10, 20 years old. Joan, 10, 20 years older than me. But they were all like my little aunts. And when we would have meetings, like I said, I would cook dinner, and we would sit down and we'd have dinner, and it was almost, you know, it was like, it was very family. The board had a very family feel. It wasn't necessarily, we weren't looking for, you know, donors to be on the board. We didn't have those kind of people in our community anyway. So what we wanted were people who were willing to work. You know, and that believed in what we were doing. But it was everybody knew everybody. We were all friends. The older generation hung out together. And so it was a very close-knit board of people who not only interacted as part of the board, but also interacted personally. And, I mean, I remember, you know, snipes about the board, you know, like, but no major battles. Now, after Joan left, I mean, the board became real professional. You know, I got a lot of bankers and lawyers and, you know, I think at one point Hillary Clinton was involved with it.
On the board or just
not on the board, but I think raising funds.
Yeah, I think
for
so
it.
Too.
And I think that's when it really took off. And then at one point, the chairman of Goldman Sachs was on the board. I mean, those are the kind of people she started to bring, because when she got involved, when she became New York senator, then she started bringing in people like that. So at one point, yeah, the chairman then we started getting, you know, bank vice presidents and city council people and all. But before that, when I was there, it was just all local folks from the community who were like I said, you know, personal friends of one another.
So by the time you left in 89, it was still
that way. Yeah. Like I said, it didn't, and not until Hillary Clinton became, when she became senator, that's when I started, and I started, you know, following. I always followed it from a distance, and I started seeing who was on the board, and, you know, when I saw this guy from, what's this guy, Blankenship? Yeah, well, whoever was the chairman of the board of Goldman Sachs was the chairman of the board in Weeksville.
Yikes.
Yeah. And that's when they started, starting to get real money, you know. And that's when they built, you know, they got finished all the houses, and then they built the campus, and then they built a new building and all that. That was, I guess, the heyday of it. But it was, you know, it had become a whole different thing. And by then, Weeksville was a Brooklyn institution. You know, people, it had been around for 20, 30 years. And it was sort of kind of the most well-known institution in the community by then.
In the Bed-Stuy?
In the Bed-Stuy community.
I guess now Crown Heights?
Well, it's sort of, you know, I mean, you have political boundaries, and then you have what I call cultural boundaries. And so the political boundary says that Bed-Stuy is bordered by Tompkins Avenue in the north, Reed Avenue in the east, Bedford Avenue in the west, and, you know, Stuyvesant Avenue, you know, here. But those are just political definitions. But Bed-Stuy, when I was growing up, before we knew about the political things, it was a much bigger place. It was pretty much all of central Brooklyn. Crown Heights, we kind of knew, you know, to us, Crown Heights didn't really start until you got to Eastern Parkway. You know, all the rest of that stuff, you know, before Eastern Parkway was still Bed-Stuy as far as we were concerned. And then, and Bed-Stuy went all the way to Bushwick Avenue. You know, and for compared that we considered that Bed-Stuy, and then Bed-Stuy going another way went all the way to Marcy, you know, and then all the way to going, I guess that's going east, going west, Bedford Avenue was again the borderline. So it was a different, you know, it was a different concept of what was Bed-Stuy, and it was different than the legal, political, you know, borderlines. The same thing with where I live now. I mean, you know, there's the political borderlines of what's recognized by the city as West End, and then there's the cultural, what we call the cultural West End, which is pretty much, you know, the heart of the Black cultural movement in Atlanta. And Bed-Stuy was, you know, pretty much became that. And I actually think that it, in the 60s and the 70s, it moved from Harlem to Bed-Stuy. Not my personal opinion.
You know, because of your experience of that.
Well, because both of the Marsalis brothers lived in Brooklyn first, before they moved to Manhattan. That's what, and I guess that would have been called Clinton Hill, technically. But we, again, you know, we called it Bed-Stuy. I mean, Bed-Stuy went all the way to Clinton Avenue, you know, back in those days. Randy Weston lived in Brooklyn. There was a place called the East, which was a Black cultural institution. And they had a festival every year, and jazz musicians from all over the country would come and perform there. And that's been going on, the East Festival, God, maybe 50, 60 years. The Fulton Art Fair, again, I mean, Ernie Critchlow, Romar Bearden, Jacob Lawrence, I mean, all of the great artists that we think of now all exhibited there back in the 60s and 70s. Lena Horne is from Brooklyn. Carmen McRae. You know, I mean, it's, it, you know, I, like I said, I think in the 20s and 30s, it was Harlem. You know, Harlem Renaissance. But in the 60s and the 70s, it was Brooklyn. And I think to this, you know, and then when Spike moved and came on the scene, and to this day, to me, I think Harlem is, well, Harlem is gentrified, and it, I would say it was sort of like this. You had Harlem, and then you had Brooklyn, and then Harlem pretty much stayed here, and then Brooklyn came up to here, where it was like, now, you know, Brooklyn Academy of Music, Dance Africa, the West Indian Day Parade, you know, you got a million people in the street. You know, so it was a very, very rich cultural environment that I grew up in the, I'd say, 60s, 70s, and 80s until I left. And then when I go back now, it's still there as a friend of mine. Well, there's a whole bunch of this jazz clubs. I mean, it's just, you know, restaurants. There were no really nice restaurants in this, well, one in the whole community. Now they're, you know, they're like on every block, Clinton Avenue, Bedford, Stuyvesant, Lewis, all those blocks have, you know, I'd say maybe two or three restaurants on each block, you know, on the major thoroughfares, on Stuyvesant and on, well, it's not Lewis anymore. What is it called? Something else. But, you know, those areas off of Fulton Park, Fulton Street going back. And so, yeah, it was always a very rich cultural scene. And, of course, you know, Weeksville and that whole history thing. And I think it continues to this day.
You were starting to say earlier about the difference in your mind between revitalization and gentrification. I just wanted to make sure I understood it, because I guess okay. I missed some of it.
And this is my own definition. Mm-hmm. To me, gentrification is a bad word. If you look up the original, where the term comes from, it was coined by a English sociologist to talk about what was happening in London at the time, back in, I think, in the 70s, where old neighborhoods, people would come in and they would buy up, you know, these houses real cheap, you know, move the existing residents and businesses out, and then a whole new group of people would come in and take over the place, and the people that lived there before can't afford to live there anymore. Revitalization, what we're trying to do in Atlanta, and what I think happened in Brooklyn by accident or by circumstances, is that you improve the neighborhood, but without forcing out old-time residents and finding a place for them, and having a situation where there is affordable housing along with, you know, the more upscale housing and all the businesses and all the amenities that come with it, and that you can do that and still have that kind of income social mix, which I think is still prevalent in Bed-Stuy, because, like I said, most of the people when I was growing up, they owned their own houses and they knew what they had, and so they didn't really. Most of the, I think that the houses that were taken up by newcomers were houses that had been owned by absentee landlords or families that didn't have kids. And then they just, you know, there wasn't anybody. Or the kids moved somewhere else, maybe to California or something like that, and they really didn't. Because I have friends like that, too. And they didn't want to move back to the city, and they sold the houses. But I think, you know, I go back to the block every time I go home, and I would say maybe 70-80% of the families that were there when I was a kid are still there. Now their grandchildren are in the houses now. It's the same folks.
Wow. What do you see as the role of history and maybe even landmark preservation in revitalization? Does it have a positive influence? Is it disconnected? Is it a negative influence to be preserving historic sites in neighborhoods?
Well, I think it's, you know, I think it's a it can be a tremendous asset. In Atlanta, tourism is the number one industry by far. Now, New York, you got a lot more things going on, but tourism still is a major income generator. So these historic sites generate tourism. And so that is the whole modus operandi behind what I'm doing in Atlanta is I live in a historic neighborhood. It's on the National Register of Historic Places. Tourism is the number one industry in Atlanta. And Atlanta is the number one domestic destination for African Americans. So given all those facts, then it would seem logical that you would want to parlay that history. One of the things about history is that it can't be taken away. We will always be, the community that I live in, will always be the oldest community in Atlanta. We can have newer communities, but you can't have anybody that's older. I mean, when you're the first there, you're the first there. So that is a economic asset, you know, the history of the city. So how do you, what we're doing now is, then how you have this asset, how do you parlay it into resources that help you deal with some of the other issues that you have to deal with? In our community, you know, and in many black communities around the country, you know, you have this where, you know, we had a Publix come in. They stayed for five years. The Publix gone. And you have a Walmart that comes in. You know, God knows how long they're going to stay. And they go. So, you know, you can, those kind of things can come and go. But the culture and the history of a place is there. It's part of the people. It's part of the place. And it can't be, I mean, you can ignore it, but you can't take it away. You know, and if you are aware of it and aware of what kind of economy and culture you live in, it can be parlayed into what we try to do is a different kind of economic development. During most of the 60s and up until now, most of the economic development has been what I call needs-based development. In other words, you go to a fund and say, we need this, we need this, we need this. And 9 times out of 10, what happens is that you get a grant, the grant gets spent, and nothing has changed. And, you know, there's no, you can't look at anything and say, well, where did the money go? In Atlanta, in the community that I've lived in, they've pumped in over $100 million. And it's, nothing's changed, not really, in terms of infrastructure. Whereas with the method that we like to employ is called asset-based community development. In other words, what are the assets that the community has and how can you parlay those assets into more resources to deal with the issues that you need to deal with? So I got involved with an organization called Creating Vibrant Communities, and we did a neighborhood asset survey. And we discovered that we had over 120 acres of vacant land, and we had people who had farming skills. So we created a urban farming environment, and we developed 9 community farms and gardens in the neighborhood that employ people and sell organic, fresh produce to people in the neighborhood. So we've dealt, using those assets, we've dealt with food desert, we've dealt with employment, and so we're doing the same thing with tourism and preservation. We're trying to preserve, you know, the neighborhood. So the big thing in black communities have been always, well, let's spend our own money in our own community. And I'm saying, well, we can do it even one better. Why don't we get other people to spend their money? In addition to keeping our money here, you know, why don't we, you know, get people from other communities to come here and spend their money too? And so that's what we've been doing. And I would say 50 to 60% of my tours are from people who don't live in the community. Mm-hmm. Because it's become a hot new community. Everybody wants to come. Half of the people that come on my tours are people who are looking to buy houses. Because they ask me questions about, what's the police response time? Is that house over there? You know, they see a house that's boarded up. You know, do you know who owns that house? No, I don't. Even if I do, I don't tell them. So, yeah, I think that culture and history is a not only a cultural and historical asset, it can be an economic asset.
Yeah.
Tourism is a big industry.
Yeah. I wrote down something you said that really stuck out to me, is that history is something that can't be taken away. And in the case of Weeksville, it's like it feels like you almost lost that story. And if it wasn't for this perfect timing of the interest in the schools and the interest in society in revitalizing that history, it might have been lost. People might have forgotten about it.
Well, let me put it this way. Like I said, you can't lose it. It can be ignored, but it can't be lost. It's always there. I mean, the facts are the facts. Now, there's a saying that the winners write history. And I think that has been the driving force behind history for most of human history. Up until, I think the game changer has been the internet. Now, everybody, I mean, I can talk to somebody, I can get on my phone and get on the internet and communicate with somebody in the Soviet Union for what, $50 a month and a $40 phone. You know, I can talk to anybody in the world. And I think that has allowed, and then also I can access, one of the things that really amazed me when I started, you know, discovering the internet is that I can get on the internet and access the Louvre. I can access the Smithsonian. I can access the London Museum. I can access the Hermitage in Moscow. You know, my assets, you know, I can, a car or Johannesburg or Cairo, you know, and then I can communicate, you know, I can see, I can go to YouTube and see lectures by John Henry Clark and, you know, all kinds of African scholars. Whereas before, you know, you either had to be in a university or you can go to a library, you can sit in the privacy of your home and get all kinds of information. So I think that the turning point was the access to information, making it, in addition to the social and political changes that happened, the access to it's just like the printing press created eventually the Renaissance and, you know, the Reformation, when as people got so each communication innovation has ramifications as people gain more knowledge. And with the internet, it's sort of like has increased exponentially. Because it's not just, you know, with the printing press, you still needed needed press and books, and you had to physically. I mean, you just pick up a thing and you could be, and so that increases the information supply. Now the negative or the part that is sort of counterweight to that is this whole idea of what's true and what's not true. I mean, yeah. The whole fake news, and fake news is not a new phenomenon.
No, I'm thinking about your mom going to these archives and digging things out of boxes and doing it all the slow way, but even then she's got to verify is this piece of paper, who put it here, what were their motivations.
And that's, you know, that really helped me a lot in discovering that you have to get to the difference between a newspaper article and original source material. Mm. Now, this is a letter written by XYZ as opposed to a story about a letter written by XYZ. Because when you just read the newspapers, you know, I just got finished reading a book on the arguments for abolition. And you read the newspapers that were printed in the South in the 1850s and 1860s, you know, like, what? You know, turn of the century, Yellow Press, you know, the Hearst, you know, you send me the things, I'll create the war. I mean, this, you know, fake news is not a new phenomenon. Newspapers, the history of newspapers in America are political. Newspapers started out as political positions of various political parties. Most of the newspapers were written by political parties.
I was just reading about, James Hurley was talking about a newspaper article he found about Weeksville that described it as like this horrible, desolate place, but it lined up with a time when they were pressuring the city to help them fix some flood damage, and the city was saying the property values weren't worth it. Mm-hmm. And so he looks at this newspaper article and he's just like, well, the motivations of the time are so clear, and the way they're trying to shape the public view about the value of not just the place, but of the people. And so that gets him interested in doing the research of like, well,
what's the truth?
What's real? How do you find Weeksville?
And it's even in black communities like Rose, you know, Rosedale, Florida. There was Greenwood. Where's Missouri. But there were a lot of, during the turn of the century, there were a lot of flourishing black communities, which a lot of them, you know, were, and both in Florida and in Greenwood, I mean, they were decimated. I mean, they were just, you know, when they just, you know, at a certain point when poor whites started to see, you know, a black middle class, it became confrontational. You know, the least amount, you know, of spark could wind up, well, it did wind up getting both of those communities destroyed, I mean, physically. So, you know, yeah, I think we have to, you know, what she taught me was, you know, to go to original source documents as opposed to the press, because this whole concept of a free and independent press is a relatively new, I would say, late 20th century idea. Before that, everybody knew that, like I said, the origins of newspapers were political parties. Those are the first people to write papers. And then not until the turn of the century did independent people, but they were always, you know, like William Randolph Hearst. You know, these were business people that had a particular point of view. This whole manifest destiny thing, you know, American Empire, all of that was fed by the press, you know, in trying to convince people that they needed to go overseas and fight. I mean, how many people know about the Philippine War? You know, I mean, we fought the Philippine, you know, people who know about the Spanish-American War. But when you ask people, so did you know that we had a war with the Philippines that lasted 20 years and that we killed 100,000 people? And that we were the first people to have concentration camps. It wasn't the Germans. And as Americans. And, you know, of that 100,000 people that died, most of them were women and children. Died from diseases in the camps. And it wasn't, and the other thing that ignores, you know, really pisses me off, is when newscasts say Afghanistan is our longest war. It's not. By a long shot. The longest war in America is the war against the native population, which lasted for 100 years. From the time that the country was started until the 19th century, we were at constant war with some native population. In fact, America has been at war with, and people think, well, that's not a foreign war. Yes, it is a foreign war because they were a foreign country. It wasn't part of the United States. You invaded a foreign country and ethnic cleansed the population, the ones that you didn't kill, and you took their land. I mean, basically, leaving space, which was Hitler's justification for the invasion of Eastern Europe, is no different than manifest destiny. It's the same thing. That a certain race of people has a destiny through their ethnic superiority to enslave other people. And in fact, in Mein Kampf, Hitler references, you know, all I'm doing is what the British did in North America. You know, so, you know, all of that is fed, you know, I mean, a lot of people they call Hitler a dictator and all that. He won election by a landslide. That's how he first came to power. He won an election by a landslide. In 1936? But because, you know, the press, I mean, he became a dictator over a while. I mean, I think we're beginning to have some, you know, I mean, a democracy is not given, it's not guaranteed, you know. it can change.
Yeah.
And the history and how you look back on it, you know, in hindsight, you know, you look at Vietnam, even World War One, you know, what we call World War One. I mean, the first real world war was what was called the Seven-Year Wars, which was between France and England. It was the first war that was fought on every continent. At least it was even more of a world war than World War One, because it was actually part of it was fought in America, in what we call the French and Indian War. But that same war was being fought as the 7 years war in Europe, in Africa, and in Asia, and in South America, all at the same time. So that was the first, and that was a real world war, because it was fought on every single continent, whereas World War One and World War Two were not fought on American soil.
So what is this this relationship with history that you got from your mom? I mean, obviously it informs the way you see the whole world, this eye of...
History should inform everyone. And I think one of the major problems in American politics and government is this lack of understanding of what our history is. And that's why we keep on making the same mistakes over and over and over again. You look at the Civil War and Reconstruction. And then, you know, what happened after Reconstruction? You had this regression back into Jim Crow. I mean, there's a book out called The New Jim Crow by this woman called Michelle Alexander, that talks about, you know, how people are disenfranchised because of mass incarceration. And there's another book called The New Slavery. Slavery by Another Name. And basically what happened after Reconstruction was this whole mass incarceration and prison labor. And so the same, you could be arrested for vagrancy. So what they would do is they'd push the people off the plantation. The sheriff would come by and arrest them and then sell them back to the same plantation that they just got off. And that lasted until the 40s. You know, so a lot of people, depending on, people don't know that. And when I talk to people, when I do my tours and I tell people stuff, and I'm talking to most of the people that take my tours are what you would be called millennials, people in their late 20s, early 30s, college educated, and they don't know this.
How do you said history can be ignored, and when history is ignored, they don't know these things. So how does history get rediscovered? I mean, you've lived it through pulling Weeksville back together, but then...
That's how it's done. I mean,
things get thrown down a well. And then that well gets covered over, and then a development company wants to come and build houses on it. But it's not a given that there'll be a community like yours that says, hey, wait a second,
no.
Can we go look in the well for pictures first?
I believe in the ultimate goodness and progression and spiritual and moral evolution of the human race. There are dips. There was a saying that Obama... like to say, he was quoting someone else, I don't know if it was Martin Luther King or somebody even before that, is that the arc of justice,
arc of history,
is long, but it's always going upward. So if you look at history, it's sort of, instead of it going like this, it sort of goes
up and like down, up, you know, some down's bigger than others.
Yeah, you have, you know, dark ages, you have you know, after you have Reconstruction, where you have black senators and congressmen, and then you have Jim Crow. A lot of people call the period between the 60s and now the second Reconstruction.
Wow.
Okay? Yeah. So, and now, and so you're having the same thing that happened after the first Reconstruction happening after the second. So you got this backlash. You know, all these people of color got too much power. We got to, you know, a lot of people, you know, again, in my social intellectual circle, called Trump the last great white hope. You know, there was a whole saying called the great white hope. Are you familiar with that? Okay. around the turn of the century, there was this black boxer called Jack Johnson, who won the heavyweight channel. There's a documentary which you, if you're interested in history at all, you really need to see. It's called Unapologetically Black. And Jack Johnson became the heavyweight champion of the world. I think it's around 1805, something like that, around the turn of the century. And so there's this thing came out where they had to find somebody white to beat him. And that became, and there was a movie and a play about it called The Great White Hope. Again, probably before your time. But back in the 60s, there was a guy wrote a play based on his story, and it was called The Great White Hope. James Earl Jones played Jack Johnson. And then there was a movie made, again, called The Great White Hope. And so there's this whole ebb and flow of race relations, you know, in America. You have this spurt, and then you have a backlash. Now, the difference now is that they, you know, most demographers predict that by 2020, mid-20s, yeah, that Europeans will no longer be the dominant population in the United States. In some states, it's already happening, California, and that this whole thing to Trump is a reaction to that, is that, you know, if we don't suppress them now, then we'll lose control of the country. And when he says, we want to make America great again, so what is that? What is that code for? I mean, anybody that black in America, anything in the past is not good, you know? And so somebody asked him once, well, when was America last great? And he says, around the turn of the century. And so what was happening in America around the turn of the century? Black people were being lynched. Women couldn't vote. And we were in war with the Philippines and Cuba and, you know, basically being a regional bully. And we had just finished annihilating the last Native population. So that's their definition of when America was great. And it's probably in terms of that mentality, yeah, they were probably right.
Talking about rewriting history.
Yeah.
We only have a few minutes left. Can I ask you something?
Sure.
Where are all your mom's papers going to be archived? And where are all of your films going to be archived? How are these things going to be saved?
Well, you know, it's very interesting that you asked that, because I just started thinking about that.
Just now.
Well, not just this minute, but in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
I've done a number of films, and I just, over the years, I just sort of never really, because a lot of them were for other people, and I just never, I mean, I'm beginning to collect them now, and I don't know what I'm going to do with them, but I'm at least have them, try to collect them. There's a piece that I did called Notes and Tones, which is a video version of a book that was written by a jazz great called Arthur Taylor. And what Arthur Taylor did, he went to all of his contemporaries in jazz. I mean, Marcellus, Ron Carter, Abby Lincoln, Milt Jackson, you name it. And he did interviews with them. And so we went back and did video interviews. We got maybe about 30 hours. Wow. And I've never completed it.
Oh, my God.
And I don't even know where the tapes are right now. And that's one of the reasons I'm coming back to New York, is because I know the person that last had them. Because when I left, it's a long story, but, you know, there's always a backstory. But in any event, I left Atlanta. I left the tapes in the custody of somebody, and I really had been preoccupied. But you know, you're right. I mean, maybe a couple of years ago, I was thinking, wow, I mean. And I did a Google search and said, I know somebody, I know if he took the tapes, he probably, you know, they're on the internet somewhere. So I Googled it and I couldn't find him. Yeah. So those tapes are sitting in somebody's office room somewhere. And I, you know, I don't think they're commercially viable, but I think that, yeah, that you know, most of the musicians that we interviewed and Art himself are all dead.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting question. I'm working on it, and I'm decided to, every time I come to New York, to try to spend at least some of that time trying to recapture. I mean, I have 100 videos that I've shot that I think might have some historical value that I don't know where they are.
Wow. And I mean, the follow-up question is, you know, what about your mom's papers and your Aunt Bonnie's papers?
Well, I've just begun to think about that. And mother's, she has this room in our house. And like I said, she has her notes from the first week's full meeting.
Yeah.
She showed them to me.
Yeah.
And she has about 7 books of photographs. She's a real collector. She is. So I don't know what we would do with it. I would probably give that stuff to Weeksville. They're probably the only institution that would be interested and have the resources to maintain it. So that's probably, at this point, what I do with it.
Do they know about the room? Might want
to
let them know.
Part of the problem with getting old is that, you know, this is my, what, 3rd executive director at Weeksville?
Oh,
yeah. Tia just left. I was just when I got her trained, she ups and leaves. Because we had developed a really good working relationship. She was interested in all that stuff, and you know, I did a similar thing for them. And there were a lot of I forget that these are new people coming in, and so they brought me up one time just to identify photos. They didn't know who were in these photographs. And we have like 1,000 slides.
Wow.
And so I did just, put the slide, who's that? Who's that? And so that's the kind of stuff we're doing now. And that kind of brought me back to what you were saying. Then I started, after I did that, I said, well, what stuff? I have some stuff, where is it? And maybe I should go try to find it. And so that's kind of, I'm dealing with that right now, and I've just sort of started that process. And probably my mother's papers and Bunny's papers will go to Weeksville. Bunny had an incredible art collection. Mm. I mean, incredible. I mean, every major African-American artist from the 60s and 70s. I mean, Romar Bearden, Jacob Lawrence, Charles White. I mean, her collection is worth a couple of $1 million, easy. Now, her daughter has it, and luckily her daughter understands what she has. And so it's all warehoused and, and appraised and all that. I understand her position. I mean, you got to be careful. I mean, like I said, Romar Bearden now is maybe worth $250,000. She got 2 of them. 2 big ones. Jacob Lawrence, I mean, and he's all, these guys are all deceased, their typical piece goes for 6 figures. Charles, I don't know how much, Charles White might be worth $1 million by itself, and it's just a small little hand charcoal painting. So, yeah, we're still figuring out how we're going to do that. I would love to, my mother's, in addition to being an amateur anthropologist and historian, she's an incredible fabric artist.
Mm-hmm.
Her stuff has, been in the Smithsonian in the International Review of African American Art. 2 of the most prominent books on African American quilting mention her.
Wow.
One, what's this guy with the Smithsonian? I forget his name, and another one's Carol Mazzalumi. So both of those books mention her, and she's in both of those books. We've talked a little bit about it, and I'll probably, get most of that stuff. And the art I'll keep, though I wanted to do an exhibit of her stuff at Weeksville. I'd like to do that. And then I don't know if they could handle Bunny's collection. I mean, just the insurance alone would break them. But at least maybe some of the pieces from her collection.
I mean, as an owner and a person that does it, you know, it's really with stuff of that value. The best way to keep it is, unfortunately, in storage, you know. And I don't know. I mean, it takes a lot of energy and effort and time to mount an exhibit of that nature. And I don't think her daughter's, like, there yet. We'll see. But, yeah, that's an interesting question. We're working on that. And then there every day, you know, there's a woman in my neighborhood who has this, she turned her whole house into a museum of black collectibles. And I mean, she has like stuff back from the 30s and 40s and 50s, old newspapers, old magazines, old Jet, old Ebony magazines. Some of that, you know, really negative black, you know, Aunt Jemima and Buckwheat kind of stuff all over the house. So there's a ton of collections. How that begins to, I think that's sort of a an idea, a movement that has just begun. What do we do with all this stuff that's been collected over the years? And I think that was what the impetus was behind the National Museum of all that stuff. I would say 90% of that stuff came from private collections.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, people who were just, well, I got Nat Turner's Bible, and I've had it for like, you know, and so we are just beginning to develop the infrastructure. The Museum of, you know, of African American Art and Culture is the best example of that. And I think for smaller collections, places like Weeksville are the natural repository for that stuff. So now we have a place to put it. Mother doesn't, you know, my mother's very unassuming. She's very incredibly modest. And she's like, oh, this old junk. And I laugh. Don't throw it away. If you don't want it, give it to me. I'll take it. This old junk, you want this old junk? I should throw this away. I said, Mom, don't do that. I'll take it. So we're working on that. It's something that I just started thinking about seriously a couple of years ago. When I retired, about 4 or 5 years ago. Because then I had the time, you know, and I, you know, fortunately, I'm in a position where I don't have to work, and I have the time, and I've had the training. I've worked in museums, you know. I know people who do this kind of stuff. So, to answer your question, we're just beginning to develop the infrastructure about how does this. We know it's important. We know it has to be saved, and so now we have to build the infrastructure to make it happen. And that's kind of where we're at. That's where I'm at.
God, I wish you the best.
It's going to be difficult, but I think, you know, I mean, that's sort of why I stay in contact with Weeksville and support it in any way I can. And why I'm at, you know, the Hammond's House Museum, and why I do the tours that I do, is to do at least my part in trying to preserve what we have. And build institutions. That's the key, because we didn't really have, until the 60s, you really didn't have major historical black institutions. Weeksville was probably one of the first, actually, you know, that had any kind of national representation. So, you know, it's an operation that's in progress. Like I said, I'm an eternal optimist. And so I believe that, you know, it will be done, you know, and I'm going to, you know, in my small way, do my part. And hopefully by supporting Weeksville in any way I can, that will be part of their collection. You know, that work, that material will be part of their collections. You know, the first notes from the first meetings, you know, the first photographs, all that. She has all that stuff. matter of fact, when I leave here, I'm here until Thursday, and then I'm going down to Virginia to visit her, but also there is an event in Hampton, Virginia. Hampton, Virginia is probably the most historically significant location for African Americans in the United States. It was where the first recorded slave transaction took place in 1619. And so they have something called African Landing Day, and it's a commemoration of that event. A Dutch ship stopped at what was then called Point Comfort and sold 19 slaves, traded 19 slaves for food. And that was the first recorded slave transaction in what is now the United States. And we're coming up, this was in 1619, so we're coming up on the 400th anniversary of that event. And it's really interesting, you know, getting back into preserving history and all that. There's a backstory to that. There's a gentleman named Calvin Pearson who started this thing called African Landing Day to commemorate that about 4 years ago. And every year he did it, and it was very, very moving. He'd have people from Africa come over and talk, and maybe some local officials talk, and they'd have a historian talk. They had a film and a lecture. And then the most moving part for me is that they would have a procession to the spot where they think the transaction took place, and then they throw flowers into the water to commemorate the people who were lost on the Middle Passage. It's an incredibly moving scene. And so about 2 years ago, and he was doing this at Fort Monroe. Now, Fort Monroe in Virginia is the oldest fort, one of the oldest forts still existing in America. It was built originally before there was America, and then it was when the Dutch first moved there, and then it was something else. And then when the British took it over, it was right after the War of 1812, and it's been a military post up until about 5 years ago when it was decommissioned. And what they did with a lot of these decommissioned forts is they made them into housing, you know, recreational areas. This big one in Atlanta, Fort McPherson. In Virginia, in Hampton, is this Fort Monroe. It's a huge fort. Half of it is being given to the National Park Service because it's a national landmark. So in addition to it being the first recorded slave transaction there, it is also where the contraband order was first signed. Now, the contraband order was during the Civil War, some slaves ran away from their masters, and the Union captured Fort Monroe early in the war. And so slaves from the nearby plantations came to the fort to get what they thought was their freedom. And so their masters came after them. There was first these three guys, started with these three guys who ran away. And the commander of the fort was this guy named Ben Butler, who was a lawyer originally. And so when they came to get their slaves back, said, "This is private property, we want it back." And so Ben Butler said, "Well, it might be private property, but if they're property, you're using them to support the war by building barricades. So they, just like any other private property that's been used for the war, it is now contraband, and we're not going to give them back to you." And so when that word got out, then thousands of blacks, that's what started the stand. And so within a week, there must have been about 10,000 black people at Fort Monroe. And then it spread throughout. Then the general order throughout the South, before emancipation, there was the contraband order, which meant that before that, the Union was returning slaves to their own. And so that was sort of the Pandora's box for slavery. So after they let all these people go, and when they couldn't give them back, so the contraband order was the first step in slavery. And that also happened at Fort Monroe. So that's why. And then, of course, a couple of miles away, you got Hampton Institute, which was one of the first historically black colleges founded by white missionaries. So I just say that to say that there's this history all over, you know, and I just happened to, you know, I mean, mother didn't come to Hampton because of that. I didn't come to Hampton, but it's there. And, you know, I'm going to expand what I'm doing to that. But the backstory is that once this thing got really popular, that Fort Monroe is owned by the state and the city of Hampton. They refused to give him a permit. And so they took it over. And now they're doing African Landing Day and giving him, the whole thing was his. Now they took it over, and because it's coming up on the 400th anniversary, and they gave him like an hour
within the 2 days to do something and the rest of it. So, you know, talking about appropriating history and how it gets lost, or, you know, what's going to happen to it once they get it? I mean, are they going to tell the same kind of stories we're going to tell? Is it going to be become commercialized, which is probably what happens on the 4th of July? You know, I mean, it's not about democracy, or it is about barbecue and steaks and firecrackers, but the, you know, why is this date important? So,
an institutions thing is a double-edged sword then.
Well, you know, it's about, well, see, now, again, being the optimist that I am, I'm joining, that's one of why I want to spread what I'm doing to Hampton, so that it doesn't happen, so that get the college, get the students involved and say, even if the state is taking this over, even if we can't do it on that property where it happens, we can still celebrate it. And in fact, we can, you know, force them to give us a bigger play, and then also monitor what they're saying, what they're doing, so that, okay, if you want to take it over, that's fine, but you're not, you know, we're not going to let you dilute the message, you know, or make it into something that's entertainment as opposed to education. So it's about, even if you can't control it, at least you can monitor it and be a counterbalance to, you know, what's being said.
That's all the questions I have. Thank you so much for coming in.
Wow. It was a pleasure. I enjoy.
I'm so glad you enjoy. I really enjoyed it too. I learned so much from you. So thank you very much. Okay. What happens next? I'll get this audio transcribed. I'll send